You perhaps know that during the time when Theodor Herzl was attempting to set up Zionism, that an offer was made to him whereby there could be a Jewish resettlement in Uganda. And that created quite an upset in the Zionist movement at the time, because there were a lot of people, Herzl himself for a while, who were attracted to that particular proposition. And it has to be said that if that had happened, well, modern politics would be very different from what they now are. Can you imagine an Israel that was settled in the middle of Eastern Africa, surrounded by nations like Sudan and Zaire and Tanzania and, well, a bit of Uganda, I suppose, and Kenya, so that we'd have, well, in our mind's eye, things like Moshe Dayan meets Idi Amin. That would have been the sort of confrontation that we've now been thinking of. We'd be thinking of a South Africa-type nation, a powerful, strong, prosperous people who were surrounded by impotent, well, shall we say, developing nations that were no match and certainly no challenge. Or, for example, if Moses had turned right instead of left, you've probably heard the old joke, have you, that if he'd turned right instead of left, Israel would have got all the oil, whereas he turned the wrong way in economic terms. But imagine, for example, that there had been, as Israel came out of Egypt, a crossing of the Gulf of Aqaba, and Israel had gone down into Saudi Arabia. Yes, I know David Fassold and others think that's what's happened, but I'm sure he was wrong in that situation, and that Sinai is not in Saudi Arabia. But imagine that it had been, and that they had gone down in that direction. After all, there's the empty quarter in that particular area, isn't there? And if God could bring water out of a rock, he could have made it habitable. And Israel could have been settled then in the middle of nowhere. It would have been a little quiet oasis for them, of prosperity and calm and fruitfulness, without all the pressure that now exists, without all the nations that would have been pressing upon them. They would have been able to find quiet pastures. They would have been able to find still waters. Indeed, they would have found the very sort of life that we really want. To find somewhere where we could be quiet, without the press of humanity, without all the challenges and the difficulties that now confront us in a dark and evil world, God could have made it possible for them. Yes, yes, I know that God had to bring them back to the land of promise, but after all, God could have promised them that land. There's an interesting little expression in what the Apostle Paul said to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17, where he was talking about God choosing and allotting. And what he said was that the God who made the world, from one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the times set for them and the exact places where they should live. That's Acts 17 and verse 26. God determined the exact places where nations should live. So God could have arranged it, but Israel was somewhere other than where they presently are. And you know as well as I do that the piece of land that God chose was an extraordinarily difficult piece of land for any nation to live in. It was a thoroughfare for the nations, wasn't it? The press of north and south, and with the Fertile Crescent, it was such a narrow little piece of land. And because there were nations all around, and because they were hostile and difficult nations, Israel was right there in the middle of a problem from day one, and they were always being looked at. In a way, it was like living in a goldfish bowl. "This is Jerusalem," said Ezekiel. "I've set it in the midst of the nations and the countries that are round about." It was a deliberate choice then on God's part to choose a strip of land that would be difficult and awkward and challenging and visible in the midst of the countries and the nations that were round about. And God, of course, has chosen our lot and our situation with exactly the same care and precision. He's put us deliberately in the middle of trouble. He doesn't want us to have spirituality without humanity, which is perhaps what Israel might have liked, a little oasis somewhere away from trouble. He has put all of us in the very middle of pressure and stress and difficulty quite deliberately. This is Jerusalem. I have set it in the midst of the nations and the countries that are round about. And do you know how that verse goes on? Ezekiel 5. Come and have a look for a moment at Ezekiel chapter 5. I was quoting there from Ezekiel 5 and verse 5, but look at verse 6. It sets the scene for much of Israel's history. This is Jerusalem, verse 5. I have set it in the midst of the nations and countries that are round about her, and she hath changed my judgments into wickedness more than the nations, and my statutes more than the countries that are round about her. For they have refused my judgments and my statutes, they have not walked in them. So God was saying then that Israel had an opportunity that they threw away. Where they were meant to be was that they should display the goodness of God and the wonder of his law to the nations that were round about, and instead they appropriated and were influenced by the nations that were round about. And the effect was then that Israel was absorbing what the nations around should have been absorbing. They were absorbing evil influence where they should have been projecting good. It's exactly the same, of course, that the apostle was saying back in Acts chapter 17. He makes a comment there where he says that God is an allocator and a distributor of territory for a particular purpose. Do you remember how that verse goes on? It's verse 27 now, which says, that they should seek the Lord. That's why God allocates and distributes. That's why God disposes in the way he does. That they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. So that God has placed us where we are in the circumstances of our own lives, so that out of the pressure of that particular position, we might be able to find the Lord. And we need to do that badly. Count it all joy when ye fall into diverse temptations. That's James, remember, saying that the pressures of life are the very rungs that we need to climb the ladder of spirituality that alone can bring us to where God wants us to be. So where were Israel then, in the context and the setting when the book of Judges begins, with all the press of nations round about and all the opportunities that they had? Well, they were in the days after Joshua. And Joshua, of course, is a little envelope. If you look for a moment at the beginning and the end of Joshua, you'll see the force of what had been happening during the life cycle of that faithful man. Joshua was a man, one man, remember, whom God had appointed to be a successor to Moses, through whom God brought consistent deliverance. He was always there. So that the record begins, Joshua 1 and verse 2, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, thou and all this people, and to the land which I do give to them, even to the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given unto you, as I said unto Moses. And then he catalogues it. And wherever you go, says God, I'll be with you. So there was a man, one man, who was right at the head of all that was going on, leading the people into the promised land. This land that God had so carefully chosen and had allocated. But as the book of Joshua comes to an end, now flick over to Joshua 24, you'll notice that that whole epoch ends as Joshua falls asleep. There it is, verse 29 of Joshua 24, and it came to pass after these things that Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old, and they buried him. So there he was, it was over. Verse 31, Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, and which had known all the works of the Lord that he had done for Israel. The bones of Joseph were buried, and there at verse 33, Eleazar the son of Aaron died, and they buried him in a hill that pertained to Phinehas his son, which was given him in Mount Ephraim. And there the record ends. The envelope is suddenly sealed. One man had led Israel into their possession, a spirit-filled man who had been with Israel to go out and to come in, and all the time there had been that consistent leadership. And now it's over. And another generation has come. And there's just a hint of that, isn't there? Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died, and they buried him in a hill that pertained to Phinehas, his son. So that a new record now opens. As one door closes, another opens, and a generation has now come which will no longer see one man at their head. Just the sort of generation in which we're now living. No one man who is controlling and leading and guiding and directing, but instead responsibility passing down the chain. So that as the book of Judges opens, we're seeing an entirely new generation. Actually, it's just like this Swanwick when you think about it. We're a mixture of generations, aren't we? But the older generation is always passing away. And another generation is having to come in the footsteps of those who have gone before. And the clearest possible divide now comes in the book of Judges. Joshua had been such a great man, such a faithful man. He had been able to carry Israel with him and to direct them and lead them in the way that God would have them to go. And now, suddenly, responsibility comes down the chain to every one of us. Of course, we rather pride ourselves in the situation that that is our ecclesial and communal position. It's the priesthood of all believers. It's the fact that every one of us is responsible for moving the truth forward, for upholding and conserving the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. That there is not one of us who has been baptized in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ who is not charged with that solemn responsibility so to move forward. No one person, but now passing on to many others. And that's why we're caring for our children, and that in many places on the campus at the moment, younger people of different ages are being spoken to as well about these very issues. Because we believe in the importance of passing the truth down the chain. It's always been like that. If you look at Psalm 78 for a moment, you'll see the psalmist concerned to make sure, well, in the days of David, he was writing, he was Asaph. And he said there, Psalm 78 and verse 2, I will open my mouth in a parable, I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known and our fathers have told us, we will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God, and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit was not steadfast with God. The children of Ephraim, being armed and carrying bows, turned back in the day of battle. Interesting, we don't know precisely that very incident. It might have been the encounter when the Benjamites were almost being wiped out. The very same word occurs, for example, about suddenly Ephraim's haltering approach, their lack of courage, their failure to lead. But you can see the force of what Asaph is saying, can't you? That in fact every generation has got this responsibility of passing on the truth to the next generation, and that the hope is that the generation to come might not be like this generation, but that they will be better, more spiritual, more focused, more committed, more dedicated to the things of God, that they will not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit was not steadfast with God. Asaph, of course, was doubtless thinking of how things had been in the days of Saul and how things might be in the days of David, when a man who had set his heart right with God might be able to lift them out of the slough of despond into which Saul would undoubtedly have taken them. But every generation then is charged to make sure that the next generation carries the truth on. And the very same thought comes, remember, in the New Testament too. Do you remember 2 Timothy and there at chapter 2 where the apostle is talking to his son in the faith, and when he has exactly the same concern, a concern that we of course share. One generation goes and another generation comes, but the earth abideth forever. And there in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 2, there's the apostle talking to his son in the faith, and he says, "And the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also." He's one generation, Timothy's another. He's saying to Timothy, now, you be sure you pass it on to faithful men who can teach others as well in due course. So he's looking across the range of generations. And that's where the book of Judges starts then, with a patchy past and an uncertain future. With a people like us who are standing on the brink of inheritance and wanting to go into the land of promise, surrounded by difficulties, deliberately chosen by God to hone and to sharpen them, to make them the sort of people that God wants them to be. And now as the book of Judges begins, there are some interesting flashbacks, some reflections, some comments on things that have gone before. And all the time there's a gaze towards the things that might come. Now after the death of Joshua, begins the book of Judges, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall go up for us against the Canaanites first to fight against them?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up." Interesting, isn't it, that almost certainly they were thinking, who's the next God-appointed leader then? Who's taking over from Joshua? Who'll go up for us? Who's going to do it? Who's going to lead us forward? After all, we've had such a great man at our head. Who's next? And God says, "You're next. Judah shall go up. The responsibility is yours. This is the challenge of your generation. Judah shall go up. Behold, I have delivered the land into his hand." And so all of a sudden it falls upon the tribe that was destined to take a leading role in Israel, a faithful leading role at times, who have now this corporate responsibility. And although we're only a couple of verses into the book of Judges, suddenly something happens that sets the scene for success. But unfortunately, they didn't realize it at the time, and they hardly ever remember it during the course of the rest of the book. But it's just a little happening now as far as Judah was concerned. Just imagine if, for example, if we could make a parallel in our own situation, somebody says, "Who's going to make a special effort then, and who's going to really push the truth forward?" And somebody says, "Your ecclesia." Wow, you think, what a responsibility. How could we possibly discharge it? And what would your natural reaction be? Well, do you notice Judah's natural reaction there at verse 3? "And Judah said unto Simeon his brother, Come up with me into my lot, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I likewise will go with thee into thy lot." So you can almost see the parallel, can't you? You're doing the special effort. Can we join together and have a combined special effort, and when you need preaching in your area, we'll come and help you too? We couldn't do all the billing by ourselves, is the modern parallel, as it were. But this was vital stuff, of course. Just as preaching the truth and showing the love of God in action is vital stuff. "And Judah said to Simeon, his brother, Come up with me into my lot." Of course, it's an interesting thing, isn't it, in life? And you could do it now. You can look at a situation like that and you can say, there you go then. Shirked his responsibilities. Told to do it, and what does he do? He says, "Come and help me, will you?" You can look at it like that and you can say, he could have done better, you know, if he'd have been bold and faithful and vigorous and committed and solo. Or you can say, that was a wise thing for Judah to do, wasn't it? Judah realizes the responsibility and he wants to share the responsibility. He's offering help to Simeon. After all, Judah would have known that in the blessings that Jacob had given, it was said that Simeon would have no occupation of his own. He was, like Levi, to be scattered in Israel. And Simeon and Judah in those blessings are right there, side by side. Look back into Genesis 48, you'll see exactly that parallel. So there's Judah saying to this dispersed people, why don't you come and work with us and find an inheritance with us? Which was exactly what happened. Simeon eventually found cities within Judah that became Simeon's occupation in the land. So suddenly you can turn around and say, hey, that was a good thing for Judah to have done. Suddenly you can impute Judah with good motives. You can say Judah was wanting to work corporately and was seeking strength through unity. And that, brothers and sisters and young people, that is the secret of success in the book of Judges that was glimpsed for a moment and then forgotten. You'll see it time and time again as you think through the Judges' record, that when people worked corporately, when they worked in unity, then it was that they prevailed under the hand of God. And what a powerful point there is there for us as a community. We like to go our own way and have tribal factions and fight against one another, don't we? Well, you've only got to go to a business meeting to know that to be the case. But when we pull together and draw close to one another, when we look for the things that are good and not fault-finding, then suddenly we realise that there is great strength in unity, and that building ourselves up and drawing ourselves close is the way to stand against the pressures from without. And so it was that Judah and Simeon went up together to fight against the Canaanites, and as the record unfolds, you'll notice there that they were successful. They prevailed, says verse 4, against the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and they came across this guy called Adonai Bezek there at verse 6, and they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and his great toes. And Adonai Bezek said, oh, I've done the same thing myself to the Canaanites, and you know, they couldn't fight and they couldn't run after I'd done that, and now I'm thumbless and toeless myself. Well, would you believe it? And all of a sudden you've got to take stock again, and you've got to just look at the situation. Because life is very complex, isn't it? It's not easy making judgments that are just full and free. All the time you've got to retain your objectivity. I was encouraged to notice that one sister at least had come with pink glasses, no doubt rose-tinted glasses, so that she could look at the studies and think, hey, they were really good, weren't they? And when she took her glasses off, she said, what were they talking about right now? Can't remember any of it. But we can do that, of course, in ecclesial and communal and family situations too. We can look at a corporate outcome and we can say, well, everything would seem to be right. But actually everything wasn't right in that situation. So that going together doesn't always mean that it's going to work out perfectly. Do you notice what they did? They meted out Canaanite punishment. They must have been sort of Gilbert and Sullivan fans. They were making the punishment fit the crime. If he'd done it to them, they do it to him. But of course, they were not following what the law of God had required. And again, the seal is being set on so much of Israel's subsequent history. God had made it perfectly clear that what was to happen, you've only got to go back, for example, to Deuteronomy 7 and see there, what was to happen was that this enmity that was there in the midst of the land was to be rooted out. These thorns were to be cut down and burned. This influence was to be totally removed. You can tell, can't you, as the record says, as I have done, so God hath requited me, verse 7, and they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. So that Adonai Bezek was apparently allowed to live in Jerusalem. And there again, of course, is that situation where Jerusalem was taken, Jerusalem was lost. Jerusalem was taken and lost, and there was never quite that continuity of one thing having been done and maintained and seen through. So that although there are excellent pointers at the beginning of Judges here, there are also dangers and warnings that lie quietly under the record. It's the danger of finding a middle ground, of compromising with the world and all its problems. You can imagine, can't you, the encounter where Adonai Bezek says, well, I know you're supposed to kill me, but that's a bit of a tough ruling, isn't it, in the circumstances. After all, it was probably made by a man who's dead now.
Yes, he's dead now.
And it wasn't really understanding the Canaanite position. After all, the Canaanites, we're moderate people, you know, we try and take a tolerant view of life. Look at all the kings I've disabled. Well, disability seems to be a sort of middle course. I'm sure there wasn't quite that sort of encounter. But if there had have been, well, that's where they came to. A middle ground. And in our dealing with the world, brothers and sisters, and in our compromises, and our commitments, and our choices, it's so easy to find a middle ground, isn't it? It's so easy not to be clear-cut in the way we live. Curiously, as we're younger, it's so much easier to see things in black and white. But as we get more experienced, well, so many shades of grey and other issues and other factors need to be taken into account. And so it was with Israel then, in this position. But as the record unfolds, if you come and have a look a little further on, what we now discover is, here in Judges 1 still, that there was an evident compromise. Look at verse 21, for example. The children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem. See, Jerusalem had been taken, but now Jerusalem slips back. But the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem, and to this day they were happy to live there together, side by side. And the same is in verse 27. Neither did Manasseh drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and her towns, and a list of where they dwell. But the Canaanites would dwell in that land. And it came to pass, when Israel was strong, that they put the Canaanites to tribute, and did not utterly drive them out. In verse 32, but the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. And verse 33, and watch the change, it's very subtle but very important. Neither did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, nor the inhabitants of Beth Anath, but he dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and of Beth Anath became tributaries unto them. See, first of all, the Canaanites are dwelling there, subject and subdued. But eventually the people are dwelling with the Canaanites. It's the Canaanites who have the dominant force, just in our own lives. The things that we allow for ourselves, the standards that we set, the way we choose to live, can so easily take control of us. So that in the end, we who are living in the world can so easily have the world living among us, dominating us, controlling us. And that's what the book of Judges is concerned about then. That we should break that particular mould, and that instead our minds should sharpen again onto that which God is calling us to. So what did God do? Well, first of all, God continued to send the message. For example, through Moses, he had sent back in Numbers 33 the message that if they compromised, if they dwelt in the land, then they would regret it. The nations would become thorns in their side, an open and running sore. And look at the beginning of Judges 2. And the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I made you to go up out of Egypt and have brought you into the land which I swear unto your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and ye shall make no league with the inhabitants of this land. Ye shall throw down their altars, but ye have not obeyed my voice. Why have ye done this? Wherefore I also said, I will not drive them out from before you, but they shall be as thorns in your sides, and their God shall be a snare unto you. And it came to pass, when the angel of the Lord spake these words unto all the children of Israel, that the people lifted up their voice and wept, and they called the name of that place Weeping, and they sacrificed there unto the Lord. They'd come from Gilgal, the place of rolling away of their iniquities, the place where the covenant had been made, the place of cutting off of circumcision. They'd come to Bochim, to the place of weeping. Nobody knows quite where Bochim is. It was just one of those places, I suppose, where they memorialized it by changing the name for a while. And the name doesn't matter that much, it's the sentiment that mattered. They deeply regretted. And yet, as soon as the regret was over, they carried on life as it had been before. And what God is going to say to Israel then, and through Israel to us, is that regret is one thing, but repentance is of an entirely different order. And there was only one way that God was able to break the cycle of their life. He allowed them to fail, and to fail badly. They were those sort of rungs, remember, up which they were going to climb, and at last were going to emerge into daylight. But years were going to pass, sorrow and sadness and oppression. You can see the cycle kicking in. There it is in Judges 2 and verse 11. The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam, and they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods. Do you notice that? That's interesting, isn't it? They forsook and followed. You've heard of a life of ease, haven't you? You know, a life of excitement and exhilaration and entertainment, a life of ease, it's generally called. Well, this is a life of F's, because they forsook. They followed. And look at verse 14. He delivered them into the hand of spoilers, so they could no longer stand. They fell before their enemies. And there at verse 16, when they were at their lowest, the Lord raised up judges, which delivered them out of the hand of those that spoiled them, so that God found for them deliverers on a one-by-one, a hand-picked, a tailor-made basis. Whatever the need, whatever the circumstance, God selected the person for the task and empowered that individual, man or woman, to go about. He found for them deliverers who would rescue them. And verse 17 says, yet they would not hearken unto their judges, but they went a-whoring after other gods and bowed themselves down. They failed to learn, these people who had forsaken and followed and fallen. They failed to learn the lessons. And verse 19, it came to pass when the judge was dead that they returned and corrupted themselves more than their fathers in following other gods to serve them and to bow down unto them. They ceased not from their own doings and from their stubborn ways. So there was a life of F's for you, if ever there was one. There's a life of failure and following and falling and forsaking, and God finding them deliverers who could have lifted them up, who could have rescued them and given them rest and peace and safety and prosperity, and could have pointed them the path to true spirituality. Well then, that's the challenge that the book of Judges presents, and in the Judges that we shall look at, we shall see God suddenly reaching out to raise someone up and enabling that person to go forward and to triumph, just as in our own life situation God has reached down to lift up a man who is our deliverer and our redeemer and our judge.